All right, it's about time for us to get started here. John chapter 11, we're on the last part of chapter 11. We'll probably get into chapter 12 some tonight, I think we will. But we're looking at lesson 19, if you picked up the handout in back, you might have that already. John chapter 11 is where we'll be. The plot to kill Jesus continues to thicken. In fact, now in the Bible story, it becomes just that. It is a plot. There have been times where there were religious leaders who were upset and become angry at the things that Jesus said or did, and they wanted to stone him, they wanted to kill him. But now we've come to a point where there is just an actual plan to kill Jesus. We talked a little bit on Sunday as we're getting toward the end that it's interesting that one event can bring about two very different responses from people. And in part what we're talking about was the raising of Lazarus. I mean, we could see this to be the case, and we could see this to be true with a lot of things that Jesus did. You know, that there'd be two very different responses from those who believed, those who were his disciples, and those who were the religious leaders of the Jews that were opposed to him. And we talked some at the end of the lesson on Sunday that fear of losing power can corrupt the minds of those who ought to know better pertaining to some things that they should do. And we can see that point or application with the Jewish leaders, that these were the ones that should have been able to know and recognize that Jesus was the Christ. And they were the ones most loudly denying that that could be possible and that he would be the one. In John chapter 11, verse 45, I'd like us to read. We'll kind of review as we go through this and continue in our thoughts. Verse 45, beginning. Then many of the Jews who had come to Mary and had seen the things Jesus did believed in him, but some of them went their way to the Pharisees and told them the things that Jesus did. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered a council and said, "What shall we do? For this man works many signs. If we let him alone like this, everyone will believe in him, and the Romans will come and take away both our place and our nation." And one of them, Caiaphas, the high priest, or being high priest that year, said to them, "You know nothing at all, nor do you consider that it is expedient for us that one man should die for the people and not that the whole nation should perish." And this he did not say on his own authority, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation, and not for that nation only, but also that he would gather together in one the children of God who were scattered abroad. Then from that day on, they plotted to put him to death. Therefore, Jesus no longer walked openly among the Jews, but went from there into the country near the wilderness to a city called Ephraim, and there remained with his disciples. And the Passover of the Jews was near, and many went from the country up to Jerusalem before the Passover to purify themselves. Then they sought Jesus and spoke among themselves as they stood in the temple, "What do you think? That he will not come to the feast?" Now both the chief priests and the Pharisees had given a command that if anyone knew where he was, he should report it, that they might seize him. Well, in this, as we said, you know, the heart of these Jewish leaders is exposed. Their fear of losing their power and position was the issue. That was the concern. You know, the area of Palestine was ruled by Rome. And yet they had let the Jewish leaders still kind of have some say and power and position. And they enjoyed that. And they weren't wanting to give that up. And so with the following that Jesus was gathering, was there going to be an insurrection? Well, was there going to be those who stood for Jesus and stood against the Jewish leaders? And if there was some kind of an uproar or a tumult that came because of this, what would Rome do but probably send soldiers in to put that down, and they would just set up their own rule And so now, Caiaphas is saying, you know, basically he has just said that, well, it would be better for one man to die, that being Jesus, and put this all away, than for us to lose our nation, and for us to lose our position, our place. And so now we're seeing more clearly what the concern of these Jewish leaders was. Caiaphas is an interesting kind of fella. I mean, he was high priest for some period of time from 18 to 36 A.D. Now, on one hand, that seems like, well, that's not that long, 18 years. But in view of the century before, where there had been 25 different men serving as high priest, he actually served for quite a long time. Now, there are some who say that he served for that long because, well, because he was very crafty. And he was powerful. And he knew how to put people in position. And he knew how to put people out of position, if that meant his power was going to come into question in any way. And then maybe true. That may be why Caiaphas served that long. And it may be, in part, why Caiaphas is able to even say this, you know, that it's better for one man to die than for the nation to be put in question. Oh, but there's more to that, too. The idea that he said these things, because verse 51 says, "And this he did not say on his own authority, but being high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the nation, and not for the nation only, but that he would gather together in one the children of God who were scattered abroad." So no, it wasn't just that Caiaphas was so wise that he said this. But being high priest, God used him as a prophet. He was foretelling some things that were to happen, some things that would come. So we stop and think here for just a moment, maybe get some thoughts in comments. The fact that in the eyes of Caiaphas, Jesus has got to be removed here. Do you wonder at all if Caiaphas had any idea where these words came from that he just spoke?
Once again, I think it shows how clearly the wisdom of God is, that you're right, he uses him being high priest to prophesy. Now, Caiaphas is saying it one way, hey, we got to get rid of this guy so we don't get our place and our powers taken away. But God's using this showing, yes, this is what's going to happen. He's going to die for the nation, not just for the nation only, but for all of God's people.
Mm-hmm.
I'll stop there.
You're right. Good point. You got that right. I mean, I think that's starting to, we're starting to see the bigger picture of some things here. Mm-hmm. But now, of course, the view of Caiaphas here is that Jesus has got to die, and we are the ones that have to make that happen. And even as Jesus goes to the cross, those Jewish leaders are thinking, who is responsible for that? That they are. What's the problem with that thinking?
They forgot God was.
Yeah. Did they have a part in God's plan? Yes. But what has Jesus said about this? It was a complete opposite purpose, you know, in this death. We think here about some things we've read that Jesus has said. John chapter 10. John chapter 10. When Jesus was talking about, he said, "I am the door." And he said, "I am the good shepherd." And three times in this text here in chapter 10, verse 11. "I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd gives his life for the sheep." Verse 15. "As the Father knows me, even so I know the Father, and I lay down my life before the sheep." Verse 17. "Therefore my Father loves me, because I lay down my life for the sheep." Jesus was actually foretelling the fact that he would die. And that he would give his life. It was not a matter of the Jewish leaders taking the life of Jesus. But he was the good shepherd, and he was going to give his life for the benefit of his sheep.
Rick. Well, it reminds me of what the encounter with Pilate, where Pilate said, "You know, don't you know I have the authority to crucify you?" And Jesus' response was, "The only authority you have has been given to you from above. You know, and he, you're not going to make the decisions here. That's basically what he's saying.
That's right. Which he didn't understand at all, that that was the case. You know, that God was using this.
And both things are happening here. The Jewish leaders are taking his life.
Mm-hmm.
They are.
Mm-hmm.
But he's giving his life that they couldn't take it if he wasn't willing to give it.
If he wasn't willing to give it. Yeah. They thought that they were wielding some kind of great power here. But really, Jesus was walking to them to say, he was giving his life. Sure. Just going to say, in the Old Testament, we see that pattern happen time and again. You know, God has the ability to take evil man or the motives of evil man and use it for his benefit, even use it for good. And even in the death of, particularly in the death of Christ, we're going to see that there is good purpose and good intent that comes from that. That was always God's eternal purpose, as we talked about.
I also see also that, like here, their intent is to kill Jesus and Lazarus if necessary to quiet it down, to remove the influence that Christ has.
It's interesting. The text says to me about that, he says, you know, that from this day they plotted to put him to death. That was their plan.
Yeah. And I look also after Christ arose and sent out his apostles into the world. And there again, the Jewish leaders again want to, you know, why are you bringing this man's blood upon us? And they feel that if they can silence the apostles there, that this will stop. But of course, God's plan was into Jerusalem, Judea, and into all the world.
All
and so
the world.
When the persecution comes, man's thinking is, we'll stop it, but God's plan is, you'll never stop
the
truth.
Right. That's right. And within such a short period of time, it went to the whole world.
And we've got to remember the context of what just happened. This is all coming about because Jesus raised someone from the dead.
Right. It's interesting that, of course, that you're right. That's part of what has incited this uprising, so to speak. I mean, it has gathered the attention of so many. You know, and even though Jesus, you know, is going to be out of town for a little ways, you know, in John's text right here, when you get down to like, you know, verse 53 or there, John's text just continues right on. When you look at the other Gospels, there was a period of time where Jesus was out of town. Well, verse 54 talks about him being in the wilderness of Ephraim, probably for a couple of months or so. You know, that some of the other Gospels give us a little bit more detail of where Jesus was. He was in Ephraim, and he went to some other places more in that region up there. And you don't exactly get that time frame here in John. Remember, John's a little bit more condensed on some of these points. You know, but the plan is already in place. It's in effect. It's working its way through. And more or less at this point, Jesus is going to leave and go to Ephraim for a while because, well, if he stayed in Jerusalem, some things could happen that's not supposed to happen yet. And so he removes himself from that. And so, as we said, there's a passing of time that's not recorded here in John's gospel. But soon it's going to be time for the Passover. And Jesus is going to be coming back into town here. And so Jesus went to the quiet and the safety of Ephraim. Where are we at there, Ken? Is it still up there? Everything's on. Why is it not coming up? That's on. Okay, so we got it on this side. Wait a second. Going too far here. Okay. So Jesus was in Jerusalem, and now he's going to take leave of there and go to Ephraim. Well, Ephraim is kind of this area up right around here. It's kind of hard to see, but that actually says Ephraim there. It's a little bit, you know, it's kind of the upper hill country of Judea. You wouldn't think of it as mountainous as the mountains that we have here, but it's pretty rolly. And the elevation has increased when you're there. And it is a wilderness area, is really what the text would say. And a little bit closer look here, just to kind of get our bearings of where we've been in the last chapter or so. Remember when Jesus was across the river at Bethabara beyond the Jordan, or Bethany beyond the Jordan, as some text would say. And it was over here where Jesus was at when he got word about Lazarus being ill over here in Bethany. 4 days later, he arrived in Bethany. That was the last chapter we talked about, the raising of Lazarus. And so, I mean, he is right here next to Jerusalem. And so, with the events of raising Lazarus, there was a lot of people coming to see what was going on. That's what we were looking at and talking about here on Sunday. And so now we find here in verse 54, Jesus taking leave of this area, and he goes up here to Ephraim. And he's going to spend some time there. Now, I don't have a lot of pictures of Ephraim. This is just one of the few that I picked up just real quick. You know, kind of that rolling upper hill country part, northern part of Judea. You know, that in the summertime would be just very, well, it wouldn't be green. Like, you'd see a little bit of green in this. Of course, the period of time where Jesus was there was probably a little bit more green because of the fall and the winter rains. But still, it's described as a wilderness area, you know, in the text. Mainly, it was just away from Jerusalem. I think that's the point really for us to keep in mind. And that's where he retired to, as some have said, for a while, just to be away from, you know, where everybody else was at. And soon, though, we're going to find him as he comes back into Jerusalem, as we kind of finish our way through the latter part of this chapter right here. In fact, let's see here. This last part, let's go to verse 55 again. Let's kind of read through this last part. It'll take us into the next chapter. And the Passover of the Jews was near, and many went from the country up to Jerusalem before the Passover to purify themselves. Then they sought Jesus and spoke among themselves as they stood in the temple, "What do you think? That he will not come to the feast?" Now both the chief priests and the Pharisees had given a command that if anyone knew where he was, he should report it, that they might seize him. And so as it gets close to the time of the feast, the Passover, there are those who are just waiting for Jesus to be there. Maybe there's a little bit of question and debate. You think he'll come? You think he'll show up? But there wouldn't be reason to question that a whole lot, because each of the other feasts that have taken place during the year, he was there. And we think for a moment that at each one, there was some kind of an episode that took place. There was a confrontation each time. Well, this time, the Jewish leaders are ready. Because now they're not just looking for him to see if there's going to be a confrontation, or, and they're going to get so angry that they're going to stone him. No, now there is the plan. If anyone sees him, to come and tell us. Because they've plotted to kill him now. And so we go into chapter 12. Then 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany, where Lazarus, who had been dead, whom he had raised from the dead. There they made him a supper, and Martha served, but Lazarus was one of those who sat at the table with him. Then Mary took a pound of very costly oil of spikenard, anointed the feet of Jesus, and wiped his feet with her hair, and the house was filled with the fragrance of the oil. Then one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, who would betray him, said, "Why was this fragrant oil not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor?" This he said, not that he cared for the poor, but because he was a thief, and he had the money box and used to take what was put in it. Then Jesus said, "Let her alone. She has kept this for the day of my burial. For the poor you have with you always, but me you do not have always." So now, the time of Christ's death is just nearly in sight. You know, we're 6 days, basically, away. And the preparations for the Passover have been going on. There were those already in the text that have come to Jerusalem early to purify themselves there, to get ready for that Passover feast. And Jesus and his closest disciples left the relative peace of Ephraim in the countryside there, and they've come down to Jerusalem. And to keep in mind that Jesus knows full well what's going to happen. He comes to Jerusalem knowing that he will not leave there, at least not the same way he came in. He comes there knowing that he is going to be that sacrifice, that he is going to be the Lamb. And I know that Jesus understood the resurrection. And he knew that he was going to be raised in glory and be with his Father again. But he also knew he was going to suffer a very painful death. And he knew that as he came back to town. And so as he comes back near Jerusalem, first it's to Bethany. That's where he was just at, where Lazarus was raised, probably 2 or 3 months prior at this point. Remember, John's gospel doesn't really account for that. The other gospels give us some indication that there's been some time now that has passed. But he's now within 2 miles of Jerusalem. And in Matthew's account, it tells us that he spent one of his days, at least in Bethany, was at the house of Simon the leper. And if I'm understanding Matthew's account on that, that is where this episode actually took place that we just read about, the anointing of Jesus' feet. You know, when you just read John's account, we would probably think that that was at the house of Mary and Martha and Lazarus. No, that's not what John's account says for what that is worth. And so think for a minute. Here's some questions for us to kind of work through, have some discussion. Why do you think Jesus went to Bethany? Why did he go there? I mean, the appointment that he has to keep is in Jerusalem. Why did he go to Bethany?
He wanted to see his friends.
Jesus knows he's going to die. And wouldn't there be some comfort going to his friends? I mean, when we think about those that he's closest to, there's apostles that he's very close to. But outside of that, as far as close friends, and with apostles, there's at least one he's not so close to. But when it comes to friends, I mean, Mary and Martha and Lazarus are those who have been identified as those he's closest to. It's not really so surprising to me that he would go to Bethany, that he would be with them and have some time with them. And also, maybe, too, it's to kind of get the timing right. It's not time for him to die yet. You know, we're still some days from the Passover. And so it seems to be that in Bethany we have Mary and Martha and Lazarus are there. The apostles are there. And Matthew's account says they were at the house of Simon. And so we try to imagine then the joy for Mary and Martha and Lazarus to be receiving Jesus here. In what turns out to be his last days. I don't think they understand it's his last days. But think about the joy that they would have because, I mean, his last visit there is when he raised Lazarus from the dead. I mean, they've still not gotten over that. And the joy that's come from that. Now, here Jesus has come back to be with them, you know, here again. And then try to imagine, you know, as they are at the house of Simon the leper, and the disciples are reclined around the table. And then the anointing that takes place. What is it about this anointing maybe that stands out as sort of different? What do you see in this? What is the event as it unfolds? And what do the disciples think? And we're given explanation as to why he would object. Because the oil that was used for the anointing of Jesus was that oil that was so very expensive, you know, worth 300 denarii. What does that tell us about the price? I mean, how do we equate that in modern terms to a price? Not in dollars and cents, but what does 300 denarii give us an indication of?
Almost a year's work.
Yeah, I mean, kind of basic wage was 1 denarii a day. Here we have. It's worth 300 denarii, you know, so it's like a year's wage. I mean, that's pretty significant.
You know, when you think about that, on the surface, it does seem wasteful. But you've got to
She's declared him to be the Son of God.
Exactly. And it's, I mean, God deserves anything that we can offer him. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's more important. He's worth anything that we have in our lives. And it's, as Paul says, it's worth dying.
You know, and it's not just Judas that has some objection to the anointing with this very expensive oil. In a couple of the other gospel accounts, you know, there's some other disciples as well that's saying, like, oh, this money should have been used for some other things. So it's not just Judas on that. Now, John, you know, he kind of sees and he pulls out of this, you know, the ulterior motive of Judas because he was a thief. You know, there's nothing that indicates the other disciples were that. They were just saying, man, that's a lot of money. You know, that could have been used for some other things. Now, the motive of Judas was, that's a lot of money, and it could be in my pocket. You know, that was his motive, you know, that was in that. But, yeah, even to the other disciples, they were taken back a little bit that, wow, that's really expensive oil that's being used.
I remember a conversation I had with Joe Olson one time years ago, Joe number one,
that's right. It was an occasion that stood out at the moment, and 2,000 years later, it still stands out. You know, it's still something that draws attention, kind of like the raising of Lazarus. I mean, it captured attention then. I mean, when you think about some things that just, that even people who don't know a lot about the Bible, they know something about the raising of Lazarus. They've heard of that at least. And yet, and here we're talking about this anointing of the feet of Jesus. And it kind of gets our attention because of the cost of that oil. Well, what else about this anointing? Is there anything else that stands out to you with that, Les? Well, yeah. That she part of this was she was rubbing her hair. What is this about? It's different. We know about some anointing of the heads of prophets and kings, but the anointing of feet, isn't that just a little bit different? I mean, is that, and I'm really asking this, is that supposed to signify something? Isn't this interesting? How did she understand this? I mean, is that truly something that she kind of knew or understood? Did she understand some things that the Lord had said before and had captured what others have been missing time and again? Because he's already said some things about not being much longer, Rick.
I'm not sure she knew what she was doing in terms of that. I think Jesus identified it. Mm-hmm.
Jesus, at the least, has made another announcement here. You know, that she has saved this for my burial. Well, there was sometimes the anointing of oil before placing in the tomb. The anointing of oil before the death. That's something that's a little bit different, that stands out here just a little bit. You know, in the anointing of feet here again, you know, we find the washing of feet. And in fact, in chapter 13, the next chapter, Jesus is going to wash the feet of his disciples. You know, kind of a signal of servitude, and he's calling them, you know, to service. Here basically was their king that was washing their feet. That's something that's going to happen here soon. But this act, as we see this, was a very humbling act of Jesus, or of Mary, you know, toward Jesus. You know, and Jesus responded here as well to the objections, you know, that were voiced. And you think about the point of his comments, you know, that there is a lesson always. There's always a lesson when Jesus has something to say. Like with regard to the expense, you know, this could have been given to the poor. Jesus says, the poor you'll have with you always. And basically what he says, that Jesus would not be much longer. I mean, again, here he's making this point, I'm not going to be here much longer. And still, as how well the disciples really understood and grasped that, I don't know. But then as the story kind of continues on, you can imagine how the word spread about Jesus being in Bethany, because Jerusalem's only 2 miles away. And there were those there plotting to kill Jesus. And so there are many that were looking for Jesus. Even you would say, there were many looking for Jesus for a variety of reasons. There were those who wanted to kill him. And there were some who just wanted to come and see him. There were some who wanted to come listen to him. Because, again, of the things that he has said and taught, the other episodes that have taken place in Jerusalem, the healings that had taken place, and most certainly now because of the raising of Lazarus, there are others who want to come and to see him. You know, and in fact, there are, as we read a little bit farther, there are some who want to come to Bethany because they want to see Lazarus. It's not just Jesus they want to see. Verse 9. Then a great many of the Jews knew that he was there, and they came not for Jesus' sake only, but that they might also see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. But the chief priests took counsel that they might also put Lazarus to death, because on account of him many of the Jews went away and believed in Jesus. So what step did the council take now? Well, now it's not just a matter of killing Jesus, because now there's people going to see Lazarus too. And so now they determine, well, we're going to put Lazarus, we're going to kill him, you know, as well. And so are they trying to destroy the evidence? Is that what they're trying to do now? I mean, what is their purpose in killing Lazarus? They think if they can kill Jesus and they can kill Lazarus, that then all of the talk about the raising of Lazarus, the miracles of Jesus, that somehow this will just all go away now? Is that what they're thinking? I mean, it kind of seems that way. That's where their head is at. I mean, that's not even rational thinking. You know, we talked a little bit last time just about the place and the position that these Jewish leaders have come to. That they are so concerned, you know, about losing place and position and power and losing their nation, that now they're making some choices and decisions that it doesn't even make rational sense. I mean, first it was killing Jesus. Now they're talking about killing Lazarus too. Are they going to go back and kill the man whose eyes Jesus healed at the pool of Siloam? And the lame man who can now walk? You know, are they going to try to undo everything that Jesus has done? Is that what their thinking is becoming? You have to wonder some.
Well, the Sadducees was the most upset with Lazarus and Jesus because they didn't believe in the resurrection.
They didn't believe in the resurrection, so you know the Sadducees, you know, are upset.
Yeah. Once you make the first decision to kill someone, what difference is there if there's a second?
Yeah, that's right. If you've killed one, what's killing two? And once you've come to that point, the question is, What conclusions have you drawn at this point about the heart of the high priest and the Sanhedrin? What do you say about that? Cold and calculating, yeah. Brutal. I mean, they're not thinking about what is God's will in this anymore, if they even had been. They're thinking now just about their own skin. And it was Jesus who said that you shall, you know, you know a tree by its fruits. And of these leaders, we know who they are now. I mean, if we've been wondering at all up to this point, we know who they are. Yeah.
Because it wasn't of God.
It wasn't of God. Exactly right. Okay, and here's the question we end this with. What can we learn about ourselves from watching the actions of these religious men? What are the warnings that come out? What are some things that we need to be careful about? Just because someone's called a religious leader does not mean that they are a leader of God. What else? What can we learn? What can we learn about ourselves? Plus.
Jesus is their self-identity. And sometimes it's a group, like the Jews and this, the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the chief priests and all that. They had such an identity that they were Abraham's seed, they were the people of God, and they were not willing to release that pride. The pride is, I think, what kept them from saying, you know what, this
could be him. That's right. Verse 47 and verse 11. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered a council and said, "What should we do? For this man does many signs." They weren't denying what he did. "If we let him alone like this, everyone will believe in him." This seems to be part of the problem, doesn't it?
Couldn't
deny.
Breathing and talking. If we get rid of the evidence, this thing will die.
So they thought.
I think they're not just getting rid of the evidence, but they are proving to themselves that they are mighty. Mm-hmm. And so if Christ is becoming so mighty that he appears to be, mm-hmm. if we could kill him, say no big deal.
Prove their own power.
We're still in control.
All right. Go ahead, Dave.
Jesus said in Matthew 18 and verse 4 that we needed to humble ourselves like little children, and these leaders didn't have a humble bone in their body.
Yeah, they were far from that. The story goes on as we read on, Lord willing, on Sunday. We finished this lesson right here. We're going to go into lesson number 20, but it's not back there yet, as you may have noticed. I just didn't get that proofed in time well enough to print it tonight. And so I'll have that on Sunday. I may just send that out on Thursday or Friday so you can have something to look at. But our plan will be to go on here with it. Jesus is about to enter into Jerusalem. as we get to verse 12 here of the text, his triumphal entry into Jerusalem, which really sets the story up for the last few days of Jesus. That's where we'll be heading to Sunday. Appreciate your comments tonight.